Hello and welcome to Growing Up B2B. I'm Ed D'Elia, president of D'Elia Associates, the place where B2B brands go to grow. For over 60 years, and now across two generations, we've been helping B2B companies achieve next-level growth through brand distinction, quality lead generation, and sales enablement. Growing Up B2B was created for family business leaders who are passionate about growth, legacy, and making a lasting impact. Whether it's a multi-generational legacy or multiple family members working together, there's something truly magical about blending business with family. And we want to celebrate that right here on Growing Up B2B. So be sure to stick around to the end of the show and find out how you can be our next guest. Okay, let's get into it. Hello and welcome to another episode of Growing Up B2B. I'm your host, Ed D'Elia. I'm the second generation president of D'Elia Associates, the place where B2B brands go to grow. Today's guest has built his life and business around a powerful idea, becoming rich beyond money. He's Noah Rosenfarb, and he's the third generation CPA, serial entrepreneur, real estate investor, and founder of WealthRive, a firm that helps high-performing entrepreneurs and families level up their financial success with purpose and precision. He's sold 8 companies, taken one public, and completed over 50 real estate deals worth nearly $1 billion. But more than the numbers, Noah is passionate about teaching others how to build wealth that aligns with their values and fuels a fulfilling life. From navigating family dynamics to coaching entrepreneurs through exits and tax strategies, Noah brings a unique blend of personal wisdom and professional expertise to everything he does. Hey, Noah, thanks so much for joining us today.
Great to be with you again. Good to see you after a while.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Let's get into it and let's get into your story. And let's start at the beginning. How did your upbringing in a family of CPAs influence your perspectives on business and wealth?
I like to tell this story about growing up with a single mom. My parents got divorced when I was 3. And in my mom's house, I always knew when it was payday. And she would work 2 jobs, sometimes 3. I knew that we had limited resources in that house. And in contrast, I'd spend the weekends with my dad every other weekend. And he was a practicing accountant. He had his own small firm. And so many of us, we'd have his ups and downs in business. But we'd go out to dinner and I could always order dessert. And if it were raining on Saturday, we might go bowling and then go to the movies and then go out to dinner. And so as a little kid, I started to see that having business success would lead to having more choices. And I knew for myself that I wanted to have those choices. And I saw through my father's work, the variety of businesses that he had served and the businesses that they were in. And I decided early on that I want to be a CPA because it was clear to me, even at a young age, that was the most trusted advisor that these clients had. And I wanted to be in a position to be that trusted advisor to others. I didn't know that I'd want to practice accounting. But I knew that it was going to be a great path for me. So that I would say I knew from an early age that was going to be the pursuit that I was going to follow.
And that's very interesting. It's not uncommon to hear that amongst many of our past guests is that early exposure, right, to that parental figure. And we sometimes, I think, take for granted how much as young people we take in just simply by observation. Right. And just watching the world and watching that older parent do their thing. And it seeps in there, doesn't it?
I sure hope so. My son is now off to college and so far has declared his major as accounting. So we'll see fourth generation CPA in the family soon.
That's awesome. So you founded WealthRive after achieving your own financial independence. What inspired you to start helping other entrepreneurs and how did that evolve into the firm you now lead today?
So I have a longer origin story, but the shorter way to say it is that I was sharing my experience by speaking on stages to groups of entrepreneurs. And after I would speak, I was retired at the time. I didn't own an operating business. I owned plenty of businesses and I own lots of real estate, but I didn't operate anything directly. And when I would share my experience, the thing that people would come up and ask me about most was taxes. And I would tell them, I'm not available for hire. I'm happy to go for a walk with you or have lunch with you or let's have a Zoom one morning when I'm out on my walk. But I didn't want a job. And at the time, I was spending most of what might be called working time, donating my time to the philanthropic causes that I cared about. And it wasn't filling my cup as much as I had hoped. And so here I was speaking and people asking for help, and then going to a board meeting where I was around the table with 20 other community members, all there to make a difference, but not really making a direct impact. And so when I reflected on that, I said, the reality is, I really like entrepreneurs. They're the people I've always thought were heroes. They're the ones that create the jobs. They're the ones that innovate and make the world go around. Why don't I support them? And the best way to do that, because they don't need my charity, is to create a for-profit business, build a team of accountants, lawyers, and financial planners, and create the capability for them to access the type of thing that I had done for my family and leverage it.
Cool. So along your journey already, you've sold 8 companies and you've taken one public. What are some lessons, maybe a hard-earned lesson from one of those exits that you might now inspire or teach others to avoid? Something to watch for or be cautious of?
The hardest lesson I learned was more recently, which was that I was taking risks in my investments that were not required, because my life wasn't going to change whether or not I was successful in those endeavors. And it brought on in the end, because obviously those risks didn't pay off and I lost a bunch of money, not only my own, but other people's. And it really just reflected on me to say, why did I do that? What was I hoping for? That extra, I had the good fortune of having a long run where my average return in real estate investing was 27% per year, which is amazing. But in order to do that, I had to take a lot of risks, which ended up going against me in a series of transactions where I lost all my money and all the money that I had invested in that deal, not all the money I had. And one of the commitments I had made to my wife early on in our relationship was that I wasn't going to risk our financial security. And that was important to me because as a practicing accountant and as someone in the business community with lots of entrepreneur friends, I've seen people lose everything. And I always knew I didn't want that to be me. I didn't want to have a comeback story. But at the same time, here I was taking these outsized risks for outsized returns, not really thinking about the consequences of when things turn against me. So I think that's really repositioned my mindset to becoming a more conservative investor.
And is that how you would guide clients as well? To be?
Yeah, because we talk about this philosophy of becoming rich beyond money. And a key component of that is having passive income that exceeds your lifestyle expenses. And so once you have that objective, then the extra money, it may not have a clear purpose other than ego or something else that may be driving an individual. And I couldn't really clearly identify for me, what is that difference? I don't have a cause that's clear to my wife and I that we're going to support where I could say, oh, this additional effort, like one of the things we do is we send a couple of kids to college every year. Oh, we'll be able to send more kids to college. And I really want to do that. I'd like to do that, but I don't really want to take a bunch of risks to do that. I'd like to do that with money that we've decided we don't need for ourselves or our family.
Okay. You jumped ahead of me there because I was going to ask you a little bit more about that concept because it is quintessential, I think, to so much, this idea of rich beyond money. So you've defined that a little bit for yourself. How do you go about helping others define it for themselves?
Yeah, the rich beyond money concept doesn't have a set definition that applies to everyone, but there's a framework that we apply that does resonate with everyone. And really, there's three main components. So one is, how do you achieve financial freedom? What does that look like? How do you have that passive income, but also have the things around you that enable you to feel like you could do what you want with your money? And when you have the money side set, then it's looking at your calendar and what we call it, creating your ideal life, and making sure that the things you're doing with your time are the things that you want to be doing with your time. And got a quick exercise for that. I used to do it by going and buying a lottery ticket. I buy that lottery ticket every time the lottery hit 300 million. That was my number. So 300 million, I go buy a ticket and I'd sit down and answer 4 simple questions. If I won this lottery, who would I spend more time with and who would I spend less time with? And what are the things I'd start doing and what are the things I'd stop doing? And I think that leads others who answer those questions to what is our ideal life? What do we really want to be doing? And so often I found that the answer to those questions wasn't, I've got to win the lottery. It was, I just needed to be more thoughtful in my planning. I needed more courage to live the way that I wanted to live. And so that's the life piece. And then the third area, which is really the toughest to tackle, is finding meaning and purpose. And most entrepreneurs get the majority of the meaning and purpose in their life from running their business. So if they no longer own their business, my last book is called Exit Rich Beyond Money, because partly when you no longer own your company, if you're going to continue to become rich beyond money, you're going to need something that brings you that meaning and purpose in your life.
And that's such a huge point, because I've seen, it's ironic, you see somebody that exits their business for a large sum of money, and you would think that they'd be elated. And briefly they are, but then suddenly there's almost like a depression that sets in, because it was clear that they hadn't really thought about, what's the next step in my journey? What will I do now?
And it, for most entrepreneurs, 75% report a level of dissatisfaction after the sale of their business, which is a surprise to most. And in part because it's a bit of an embarrassment to most entrepreneurs. They don't really know who they could share. Oh, I just cashed the biggest check of my life, and now I'm miserable. Nobody wants to hear you complain when an eight-figure wire just go into your bank account. So there's a bit of shame involved. And so what one of the missions that I have is to prevent people from saying that they're less happy after they sell. I want them to be more happy. I want them to know what it is they're going to do with their time and their money and where they're going to find their meaning. And we have a series of exercises to help them do that. We have a series of strategies to help them get there. And like I said, for me, it was sharing my experience with others, where I really enjoyed the in the speaking that filled my cup. The noble causes, which are meaningful to me, didn't do it by itself. I find more joy in giving away money than giving away my time. And I find more meaning and purpose giving my time to entrepreneurs who can really make the best return on that time. They can generate a real positive impact, and the financial rewards I receive can then go and support these causes I care about.
That's awesome. That's awesome. In your travails, I'm gathering you frequently come across the family governed business, whether it be multi-generation or siblings together, husband-wife teams and the like. And certainly working with a family governed business can be very rewarding, and it can also be a little bit challenging. So maybe talk for a minute about some of the challenges you faced in that family governed business and how you as the outsider helped to mitigate some of those challenges or obstacles, or even if there's a little bit of conflict, how do you help them work through that?
Yeah. So my broadest exposure to those family business dynamics was through the lens of litigation. So my dad was a practicing accountant, as I mentioned. I joined his accounting firm when it was 12 people. We scaled it to 70 and eventually sold it. Our focus became forensic accounting, and forensic accounting is really involving disputes over money. And so I saw lots of siblings sue each other. I saw cousins sue each other. I saw parents and children involved in lawsuits with each other. So I saw the nastiest side of family business in my early career. And then now with the work that I do, I would say I'm exposed to more of the positive side of where people are collaborating and they want to transfer ownership successfully and tax efficiently. Throughout both of those sets of experiences, positive and negative, it all comes down to communication and trust. When you look at the research, when you study how successful families beat the shirt sleeves to shirt sleeves in three generations kind of idiom that affects over 90% of families, it's very hard to maintain a family business. The inertia is against you. And the way to battle against it is through clear communication and establishing trust, which, the two somewhat go hand in hand, right? You can have great communication with no trust. You could have trust without communication. But when you put them together, I think that breeds an environment where you can have continuity, because you're able to air the conflicts earlier before they become embedded and more problematic to resolve.
Absolutely. In fact, your colleague who was on an earlier episode said it, and I'll paraphrase his words, speak your mind and do no harm. So I thought that was very well said. Yeah, certainly. That's right. You and your dad did overlap for a number of years.
Yeah, talk we worked about, together for 9 years.
Yeah, talk about that experience for a moment.
I loved it. I really enjoyed it. I didn't have the good fortune of growing up in the same house with him. I spent more time with him as an adult than I ever spent with him as a child. And it was, I've always looked up to my dad. I've admired him. He has a good business sense. He was a good mentor. And so being in the environment of seeing him work, learning from him directly, watching how he managed people, originated business, managed relationships, was very productive for me. I had access to information in a small business that I wouldn't have had if it wasn't my parent that was mm-hmm. running the company. I think I deserved the access and I made good use of it. And I helped him profit and scale the business as a result of the trust that he gave me. But I don't know that a stranger would have allowed me to do it the same way my dad did. There came a time where he moved to Manhattan. So I used to work around the corner from you in Roseland, New Jersey, and worked in the same office for 6 years. And then he moved to Manhattan. When he moved to Manhattan, we didn't have the same level of interaction because I wasn't seeing him at the office every day. And so my desire to remain in that workplace really waned because the most attractive part of working in that accounting firm was being able to spend time with my dad.
Nice. Nice. So did you ever have disagreements with your dad when you were together? Were there was ever an issue where you were not necessarily on the same page? And if so, how did the two of you come to work through that?
Yeah, we were most often not on the same page when it came to like culture dynamics and career paths and making sure that we had a working environment that the employees felt valued in. Mm-hmm. And that was because he was a bit of a tyrant in terms mm-hmm. of his management style. I would often refer to him as an asshole when people would say, oh, how's your dad as a boss? Oh, he's an asshole. And it was fine for me, but I didn't think that the business could grow if he had that leadership style. And so that became, I wouldn't call it the main source of conflict because he conceded to my viewpoint. And he agreed that building a culture, establishing company values, having facilitated strategic planning retreats, developing career paths for our employees, rewarding them for retention and helping them build their careers, that all of that was good. He just didn't want to be the one to do it.
Having had the pleasure of meeting your dad way back when, I can just attest to the fact that his bedside manner with those on the outside was far more pleasant. A very charismatic, very nice guy, and just the type of person you just want to get along with. So he saved his best for
Yeah, exactly. So, which I find is quite common in the workplace. We had another one of our partners of one of our offices was the same way. Incredibly charming with the clients, incredibly charming with our referral sources. And then in the office was essentially abusive. But sometimes I think high performers have that as their predisposition and it works for them and they attract employees who don't mind what I might call that level of abuse in the workplace because it's a good job, it's a good environment, they make good money and their boss is getting it done and they admire their results. I just never felt like that was going to lead to the best outcome for the whole company.
Yeah. And you're not alone. My dad was the same way. In fact, he'd probably find himself in court a lot by today's standards if he were around still working with that. Because you can't quite get away with some of the things that were rather common back in the 80s, 90s and before. But yeah, probably not too far from what you grew up around. So you have a very unique brand and message. So WealthRide, Rich Beyond Money, this idea of a lifestyle-driven financial planning boutique. How do you go about building that brand and getting the word out in a meaningful way?
So I would say the brand building part was very organic because, again, I was speaking on stages about tax strategy for entrepreneurs and becoming rich beyond money, which were really just more how I've distilled my own life's work and how I wanted to establish how did I accomplish my goals and how could I share the tools and techniques that I've mm-hmm. used with others. And that then led to the birth of this business. So it was very organic in its development. Now that we're really in a business and we want to scale the business, we want to help more people, we want to grow the company, grow our headcount, grow our impact. Now we're trying to expand our message predominantly through social media, including paid advertising. So we've been testing social media, I would say, for a long time, and it's been reliable in creating results. Now we're trying to expand our social media reach while still organic, not inorganic on the social side, other than paid Facebook advertising. We're still in the early innings of that. We did a test last year that didn't quite break even, which was what I would have assumed. And I wasn't disappointed with the results, but it's not something that we could fund ad infinitum. We did a second test that we started in March. We're still going through that second test. No results yet, only money going out, no money coming in yet. But I believe that the message that we have to share, one that can be distributed through social media, could be received by our target market, which, you know, is a very exclusive community, that one half of 1%, right? Mm-hmm. But they're on social media too, and they're looking to learn, and they are resonating when they see something that aligns with what it is they're looking for. So we're just trying to spread our reach, spread the message. And right now, I would say word of mouth is more effective because our satisfied clients tell their friends more so than social media, because we don't have that borrowed trust on social mm-hmm. media. So we're working through that, in fact, by gaining testimonials. So we've been asking our satisfied clients if we could use their name, if we could share their experience with others. And that way, when you meet us and you have no clue who we are, we can say, here's 10 people that, you know, have basically just told you what their story is. Yeah. That's enough. How many more do you need?
Yeah. Yeah. That's great. And that's great that they're willing to do that, that attests to their positive experience. So getting back to family for a moment. So your dad was a CPA. You followed suit, and it sounds like your oldest son may be joining the ranks of same career path. Is that right?
I should hope so. What I've shared with him is similar to my own perception of becoming an accountant, which is it's a credential that really signifies that you have a certain level of intelligence, because you can't not be book smart and get your CPA license. It's just impossible. You can be plenty smart in many other ways, but you can't be book smart. You can't not be book smart, I should say. And so that by itself lends a level of credibility. The skills and experiences that you have to get your CPA license, which is 5 years of education, 1 year of practical experience, plus an incredibly hard test that you have to pass, those are all not only the education and the experience and the signs of your capabilities, but when you package them together, they actually enable you to do a job that's required in the workforce that right now pays pretty well and is understaffed. Kind of always have a job if you're an accountant. That's been true for the last 100 years. And yeah. My guess is it'll be true for a while longer until AI replaces all of the workforce. So I think it's a good way to get trained. But I also haven't encouraged my son to think that's the end. That, oh, go get your CPA license and be a practicing accountant for the rest of your life. Because his grandfather, my father, is a CPA, but his grandfather, my father-in-law, is also a CPA. His great-grandfather was a CPA. Now, my father-in-law is a practicing accountant with a traditional accounting and tax practice. My mm-hmm. father had a traditional accounting firm that expanded to be New Jersey's largest forensic accounting firm. My grandfather used his degree and used it to run a business. He had a meat distribution business in Newark, New Jersey. And mm-hmm. he was the accountant for the company, but he was also a salesman and had client relationships with his customers who were hotels and restaurants that he would source and supply their meat for them.
And maybe this is a little bit too early to say, but will there potentially be a seat at WealthThrive if your son might be inclined
to? No doubt. Yes. I've told my children, I have a 14-year-old daughter as well as my 18-year-old son. And I've told them I would welcome them with open arms into any of my businesses at any point in time, because I'd love the opportunity to work with them. But I don't want them to feel like that's an expectation or mm-hmm. a limitation. So okay. I want them to do what's going to make them happy. Okay. I think figuring that out on their own is important. And if they want to work together with me, I'd love it. They'd have to figure out how they're going to provide value. I don't want to mm-hmm. dictate that. But mm-hmm. I know that if they can tell me what they want to do, I'll make sure there's an opportunity that I could create for them.
Okay. So the door is open, but it's not necessarily a forced entry to walk through that door, nor is the door closed where it's a no and it can't come in.
Yeah. And I would say even more than that, it's I share that it's something I would like. I would like it, but just because I would like it doesn't mean you should do it. You have to want that. And the real advantage that I perceive in terms of the success that I've been able to have in business and the impact I wanted to have on my kids is through the opportunities I could create for them, not through a gift. Mm-hmm. I don't want to say, oh, here's this enterprise that you can now take over and you're set for life because of your birthright. I don't think that's healthy for them. And I've created that should not be an expectation of theirs. And in fact, in all of our family planning, our goal and desire is not for them to become wealthy because we're wealthy. Yeah. If they want to be wealthy, we want to give them all the opportunity. I want to leverage my connections. I want to leverage my knowledge. I want to help them as best I can, but it's going to be their effort that they have to.
And I think when I look back at my journey, I was doing some house cleaning not long ago, and I came across the original valuation from when we started the buyout, albeit a lot lower back then for a variety of reasons, as well as the original buy-sell agreement, which was on a handwritten piece of notebook paper. And my dad and I both signed it. And at the time, our accountant witnessed the signing. So that was fun to find that little piece of D'Elia Associates nostalgia. To your point, I always was grateful that I bought this business. It wasn't given to me or handed to me. And as a result, I think everything carried more meaning for me that during the buyout process, I was operating as though this asset was mine or was becoming mine and that I was paying for it and that I had to make good on that asset. I think there's a different mindset when they put some skin in the game and they have to create value of that next generation. That doesn't always go that way. And sometimes it works out just fine.
Yeah. But I think I'd add one of the main sources of conflict that I saw as a litigator was when a sibling who did not engage in the business was disappointed that the sibling that engaged in the business was wealthier than them. And as a result, there was conflict. And a lot of that could have been stemmed had mom and dad sat down with the whole family to describe the transition and succession plan and gotten everybody on the same page that this is a fair transaction. So nobody is harmed by this transaction. No one is benefiting unilaterally from this transaction. Yeah. No one's harmed by this transaction. And if the parents had the courage to speak openly to the siblings that weren't engaged in the business, I think you can head off a lot of those future problems.
Yeah. And I had to go through that process too, having three older siblings, but I benefited because they all came through the business and they're like, yeah, you can have it. You want to work with that? Go ahead.
Maybe it's worth sharing. My dad, I'm one of four siblings as well. My three other brothers did not decide to become accountants. One happened to work with my dad after me. But my father's position was, I want to sell this business for the highest price I could get. And so I, of course, could be that buyer, but I didn't want to pay as much more money than anyone else in the world for this accounting firm that my dad had owned. I thought most accounting firms people were overpaying for. So I knew I was not going to be the future owner of that business.
Yeah. You touched on something I just want to maybe extrapolate on a little bit. You mentioned AI, and that seems to be seeping into every industry in some way, shape, or form. I was also thinking in the context of your son, whereas that next generation is growing up with that tool set intact, whereas those of us that are a bit older are adopting and learning it. To what extent is the adoption of AI showing up either in your business or among the clients you serve?
I'll speak to my own experience because I think it might be at least more relevant than what I'm seeing among clients. We have an AI task force. My co-founder and president is the leader of our AI task force, and the job of that task force is to implement AI in all of our business processes. Right now, what that means is we're leveraging the large language models for the most part to help us with sales and marketing. I would say that's the vast majority where the technology has been utilized. We're looking at how can we change the speed of our service. So right now, we typically take about 45 to 60 days between when somebody starts working with us and when they actually have their tech strategy developed. I want to see if we could spin that down to immediately, where they can bring the information to us and all of the analysis can get distilled through the use of the technology. The biggest hurdle right now is privacy. So in order for us to provide that result, we need to have our own servers running our own models. And I'm waiting for one of the LLM, whether it's Copilot through Microsoft or Gemini through Google or ChatGPT through OpenAI, one of those models is likely to be able to offer some privacy set at some point in the next 3, 6, 9 months. So part of me is waiting versus spending the 50 grand to do it internally right now.
Yeah. I mean, it's being somewhat immersed in it ourselves. We sometimes forget the rest of the world isn't quite, you know, have the same level of exposure. But I've always found that to be true, where we'll see something, experience something, and me personally, oh, this is going to be the next new thing. And I forget, it always takes a little time to filter down to the rest of the world. So we're in that beginning process where it's filtering down. But it's been a very interesting development, at least in our industry, but I believe in all industries. And certainly that next generation representing your son representing will have that kind of baked in there, their fundamental tool set. It'll be interesting to see what that generation can do with it.
Yeah. And one of the things I share is I don't know what he's going to be able to do in 5 years with a master's in accounting that a computer won't be able to do. It's really hard to envision other than personal relationships, personal network, hand-to-hand combat. And so what I'm trying to instill in him, they have a sales major at the college he's going to, FSU. And so I've suggested maybe taking some of those classes, because again, I think that as business becomes so much more automated and machine driven, that there's likely to be the backlash of that is more face-to-face live interaction. Whether that's, we know we're talking to humans today, there may come a time that my AI avatar can show up on this Zoom, answer as effectively as I'm answering you, probably better than me without the ums and ahs, and you may not even know. But if we're in person, you're more likely to have the advantage of knowing you're dealing with a human.
Yeah.
I think finding ways to become more human, I think, are going to be more valuable in the long run.
Yeah. And I think our position is really that in my industry, everything tends to swing hard on the pendulum. The next new thing, everybody gets really excited and we swing really hard. We swing for the fence. But then there's a comeback to a balance point. So I believe the balance point will be hybrid, where there will be AI agents and human agents, and they will be collaborating and working together to fill in the gaps for each other to some extent, because I believe there still will be some gaps based on what I've seen and been exposed to so far. But it'll be interesting to watch that progression. Getting back to some of the family-governed businesses among the clients that you've served, what's something they often don't ask, but probably should as they look to do what most families want, which is that continuity of prosperity? So where's something where there's a blind spot maybe?
I think because of the relationship that many of them have with their current tax preparing accounting firm, they rely on their advice exclusively in conjunction with potentially their estate planning lawyer on how to effectively transfer interests in the business to the next generation. And that's the most common set of advisors that you'll find when you're talking about family business succession. What I think is missing in that interplay, and again, maybe they have a financial advisor involved in that discussion, but I think what's missing most often is a layer that involves a tax strategist, because most of the tax preparing accountants are not embedded in tax strategy. They're really focused on the rearview mirror of putting numbers in boxes. That's their primary role in relationships with business owners, is to account for the numbers that have already occurred. And what tax strategists do, what the team of people that I've assembled really focuses on, is applying creativity to a situation where we can understand what the goal is, and then we're applying creativity to see how can we get that goal with the most tax efficient path possible. Ideas that we apply are often new ideas to that existing set of advisors. So it's bringing something new to the table. That presents a bit of a challenge, because a lot of times what advisors aren't up on, they're down on, because just their general distrust of a new idea. And if it's not their idea, it's probably not a good idea. But we could battle past that with the right clients that have conviction about really understanding what it might take to achieve their goals, especially tax efficiently.
Cool. Another little piece of your background. You've visited over 70 countries. That's pretty amazing. So talk about not so much maybe the different locales, but having exposure to that many cultures, that many countries, that many destinations, how has that shaped your views, Noah? Whether your worldview or how does that shape how you go about your business now? What influence has that had on
I'll
you?
give you the practical influence. So I mentioned my daughter is 14, so my son's off to college next year. He doesn't love traveling. He's been to 20 countries. He would rather be home. My daughter, on the other hand, has enjoyed the exposure and the experiences. And so next year, for her first year of high school, she's going to be homeschooled, and we're going to travel to 12, 13 different countries over 180 days in Europe, Asia, and Australia, and New Zealand. And so I think that's the living expression of how important travel is to myself and my wife and now our daughter. And I believe that the education that she'll get for her freshman year of high school in all of these different places while taking her classes online will be infinitely more valuable than if she stayed at home and went to the local high school, which she'll do the next 3 years, her sophomore, junior, and senior. She'll do that. So this gives her what I think is a much broader set of educational experiences. And I believe that seeing the world really unlocks compassion, empathy, creativity, and maybe a broader mindset in general to how we approach problems and how we think about things. And then for me, maybe, as equally important for me, it's just fun. I like the new experiences. I like tasting new foods. I like seeing new things. I like being in a new environment. There's this Enneagram test. And one of the things I learned from the Enneagram is the reason I like going to Costco and eating all the samples is I just like sampling things. And so the same is true with travel. We tend not to go back to the same places. I love to see new places because I have this desire for always a little bit of something new.
That's awesome. What an amazing experience it's going to be for your daughter. And my experience with anyone who's been homeschooled or for various reasons doesn't have what I'll call the traditional education, they tend to be bigger thinkers because a lot of what education does is says, do it this way, live within the lines, whereas they don't know the lines. So they're not constrained by some of the traditional norms of thought process or thinking. They tend to be boundless in their thinking. And what an amazing experience and what a way to both share family time and to do what you all love at the same time and give her a great and rich learning experience. That's really awesome, man. That's really
Yeah, I'm
cool.
real excited. It'll be my 50th trip around the sun. So it's a celebration of that, my 25th wedding anniversary. So,
Congratulations.
a lot to celebrate. And also, I've got exposure to many affluent families who are now in their late 60s, 70s, 80s. And they all say it's better to travel when your hips and your knees are good.
That's
You know,
right.
I want to take advantage of the life I've created. I want to live the life that I want. I want to be purposeful and intentional. And I don't want to wait for some future that's preordained by somebody else of when I should do something.
So, beyond the upcoming travel, what's something else that's exciting you right now? Maybe in your business or in the greater world around you, or something that you're looking forward and saying, wow, that's exciting, that's interesting me right now.
Yeah, there's so much. I would say back to AI. That's probably what's exciting me most. It's also what has me most uncertain. It's the double-edged sword of trying to understand how is this going to play out, and how do we get through whatever the challenges are going to be that AI is going to bring with it, the structural unemployment that we might face in certain industries, the contrast of this endless productivity that we're going to be able to generate. And so as an entrepreneur, as a creator, it's very exciting to think about how if I have unlimited labor, when you look at business models, I've never really been a SaaS business model person, but that's the most efficient business model in terms of profitability per revenue dollar. Essentially, every business is going to become SaaS because our labor costs are going to get reduced significantly. And so that's very exciting as a creator. On the flip side, I'm compassionate, as I shared, and I'm philanthropic. And so I wonder the people who are at that bottom rung, who can't meet their own needs through their own skills and experiences, what's going to happen to them? How do we support them? How do we provide that safety net to them? And I think prosperity will always continue to improve around the globe. And when we look back throughout each decade, the number of people that didn't have access to food and water has improved. And I feel like that will continue. I'm hoping that will all be lifted up. But I also look at birth rates. And it's kind of like, if we're not having kids, I get the labor part can be solved by the machines that we're going to create. But it's going to happen with the humans. So I'm very excited by what it's going to mean for me, for my family, and being on the top of the pyramid and having this kind of future that I see of abundance is incredible. And I'm excited to explore it. I think longevity is going to be impacted. It's one of the reasons I've got this Fit at 50 goal for myself. And I've been trying to improve my health because I feel like at some point, as long as I live long enough, I'll be able to live a healthier life as well into my 70s, 80s, and 90s. And I don't have to be as concerned about the impacts of aging if I could stay healthy enough to use these medical advancements to my advantage.
Yeah, awesome. Final question. If one of our listeners wanted to learn more about you or more about the work you're doing at WellThrive, what's the best way for them to connect?
Instagram, LinkedIn, those are great spots for like publicly shared information. I produce a lot of content on taxes and lifestyle and money and how to become rich beyond money. So, you know, if that's of interest to you, connect there. If you had an interest in reducing your tax bill, if you're making $1 million or more of taxable income, or you have a capital gain event that's going to produce a couple $1 million or more of income, if you go to talkabouttax.com, you could download some tax strategies that you could share with your accountant that might be helpful to you. And you could also find time to schedule a call with my team and discuss your personal situation.
Awesome. Awesome. Noah, thank you so much for sharing your insights, not just on building wealth, but hey, building an amazing life. So we've been speaking with Noah Rosenfarb, founder of WellThrive, real estate investor and trusted advisor to entrepreneurs looking to thrive beyond the numbers. And I'm your host, Ed D'Elia. Thanks again for tuning in to Growing Up B2B, and we'll see you next time. Thanks again, Noah. It was great having you on.
Thanks, Ed.
Hey, thanks so much for tuning into Growing Up B2B. To explore more episodes and insights, visit podcast.deleonet.com. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please give us a rating or review on your podcast platform of choice. Having worked with hundreds of family-led businesses across my career, and being a second-generation leader myself, I'm on a mission to help every family business I meet achieve next-level growth for their organization. So feel free also to connect with me on LinkedIn and let's support each other. You can also find out more about my company at deleonet.com. Again, I'm your host, Ed D'Elia, and thanks so much for joining us today. Take care.